You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Housing is rapidly turning into the defining issue of state and local politics here in California. By almost every measure, we are in a complete crisis of affordability. The average rental listing for a one-bedroom in San Francisco is now just under $3,300 per month. And although we are one of the world's worst regions on this front, this is part of a national trend. Cities from Austin to Portland to New York are going through versions of the same crisis the Bay Area is. The question of what to do about it is one of the single most divisive issues in urban politics today, with groups arguing that they want more affordability, staking out positions at complete right angles to each other on new developments and changes to zoning regimes. Our next guest has spent a long time working in this field and just devoted an entire book to the story of how we got where we are and how we might get out. Randy Shaw is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco. The new book is Generation Priced Out: Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me how you got started on this project.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Your listeners probably remember the Ghost Ship Fire, which occurred on December 2nd, 2016. A terrible tragedy that 36 people lost their lives. And the Ghost Ship was a warehouse in Oakland where artists and bohemian types of musicians were living illegally. And it also gave occasional evening parties. And at one of the evening parties, a fire broke out. And since there was no fire protective devices required by code, 36 people died. And only one of them was a resident. But that incident really sort of opened my eyes and just said, well, there's something really wrong when there's so many artists and bohemian types who used to be able to live in Oakland as the affordable alternative to San Francisco, but now they were even priced out of quality housing in Oakland. And I started to realize that San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley were progressive cities that were essentially, through their zoning policies, excluding the future millennial, middle, and working class. So I was originally just thinking about writing about the Bay Area, but then I started looking at other cities and I found the same story. Cities that used to historically, like Oakland, be considered affordable, like Seattle, like a lot of parts of LA, like Austin, where this movie Slacker was made, because you could pay your rent in Austin being a slacker, no more. And I saw this trend, Portland, areas that we used to always think of as affordable alternatives to the Bay Area weren't affordable, and often for the same reasons.
These are all cities that were affordable during a period where they were deindustrializing and losing population, have become more expensive as they developed a knowledge sector economy.
Right. And, you know, New York City and San Francisco began gentrifying in the late 70s, and they were expensive before the recent tech boom. But vast parts of LA, a lot of Seattle, Portland, Austin have had experienced a dramatic change in affordability since 2011.
So you start the clock in the 1970s in San Francisco, and you pin the problem on changes that started taking hold in city politics and as a consequence in city zoning. You want to walk us through them?
Well, you know, if you were in San Francisco in 1976 and someone said that, you think San Francisco has to worry about gentrification? They'd look at you like you're out of your mind. The city was still suffering a long-term decline from the 50s. By 1978, gentrification was moving forward as the tradition of what we used to call the yuppie, as the young people who grew up in the suburbs decided it was more fun to live in cities. We saw this in Boston, New York, and San Francisco. The return to the cities created pressure on the housing markets, and particularly in San Francisco, where in 1979 they passed, due to pressure because of rising rents, they passed a very, 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 very weak rent control law. That exact law, as I describe in Generation Priced Out, the nature of that law encouraged speculation, displacement, and gentrification. It made it profitable to buy a four-unit Victorian, evict all the tenants, and paint it and upgrade it. And that's what happened in the Upper Haight, the Castro, Noe Valley. So traditional working-class neighborhoods became gentrified, like the three I named, in the 1980s. And then it spread as decades have gone by to almost every neighborhood in San Francisco other than the Tenderloin where I work.
The timeline was sort of confusing to me because San Francisco keeps losing population well into the early 1980s. Why do you peg the late 70s as a point where it starts to gentrify?
Well, rent started going up in the 70s and evictions started. I mean, there was also, remember, it's hard to imagine this now, but there was a time like when Harvey Milk came to San Francisco. If you read Cleve Jones, you know, coming to San Francisco, it used to be if you were gay or lesbian, this was the only city in America, only major city you could live openly. So we had a huge gay and lesbian in-migration, which could added to the yuppie migration. So that's why they passed rent control in 1979, because there was already pressure. And that rent control law, if you look at it was backed by the most conservative board of supervisors and most conservative mayor, Dianne Feinstein, we'd ever had in a long time. So, I mean, it was a different San Francisco, very more whiter, old San Francisco, traditional Catholic white, not the diverse group we have now. So the fact they felt compelled to enact rent control showed you how things had happened, changed very, very quickly.
At the same time, as part of Dianne Feinstein's strategy for maintaining political dominance in the city, she started reining in the ability of construction companies to build in most of the city's neighborhoods.
Yeah, well, Feinstein made a political deal. She said, I want Manhattanization and downtown development and high-rise development to she was facing ballot measures trying to limit it. And in order to win votes from the west side of the city, she said, I'm going to downzone those neighborhoods. So she cut the amount of units you could build in the whole west side in half. You couldn't. So the projects weren't economically viable, and nothing has been built there really ever since on the west
side. This is the Sunset, the Richmond.
Right. And so what she did was create her political bargain, brought in all these workers to downtown office buildings, did not increase housing supply to house them, so they're going to look for places, drive up rents due to the artificial restriction of supply because nothing was being built. And San Francisco remarkably, and I didn't really think about this at the time because I was very involved in the 1987 mayor's race between Agnos and Molinari, which was like downtown versus neighborhoods. Neither candidate was talking about we need to build more housing to house an increased population. It was just kind of off. It was just kind of out of people's minds, but we paid a price to this day by not building.
Well, wasn't it a given back then that the regional development strategy was you house new people in the suburbs? I mean, the Transbay Tube for BART had just been completed in 1974. If downtown San Francisco was going to be an employment center, which it was with all the new office construction you're describing, the people working in those offices didn't necessarily have to be housed in San Francisco.
Right. Well, BART was planned in the 50s, actually, and there was an assumption the suburbia would continue. But by 1980, it was pretty clear that the trend of young people moving back to the cities was continuing. And we saw, you know, the gentrification, the whole 80s was spent in San Francisco trying to get vacancy control, which Berkeley passed in 1980.
Vacancy control meaning
control
the price between tenancies.
Right.
After someone moves out, the landlord can't jack up the price.
Berkeley passed a vacancy control law in 1980. That period of 1979 and 1980 were like the hottest transformation of these Bay Area housing markets. And so instead of saying, wait a minute, we don't want these young people who are getting paid more, the lawyers and everything working in the downtown office building, to take the units of people who are blue collar, we just didn't do anything about the supply issue. We made believe it didn't exist, and we've paid a price for it in terms of rising unaffordability.
The dominant framing in your book is on zoning.
Well, I would say I think it's twofold.
Okay.
I think what I say in the book is there's two issues that cities must do. They must protect tenants in rental housing and build more housing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a lot of attention on my talk about the building the housing, but if you read the book, you'll see I have more stories about tenants fighting off eviction and the need for rent control and strong rent control and strong rental housing protections as much as they're both in the book equally.
No. As a prescription,
yeah,
absolutely it's there in the book. As a history, as a how we got here story, your analytical framework seems to be focused on land use and zoning.
Well, that's because in San Francisco, we have the strongest tenant laws and strongest rental housing protection laws, and yet we still have incredible affordability. There are some cities, most cities, including Los Angeles, do not have strong enough tenant protections or rental housing protections right now. They need to do both. But San Francisco, it's like we're protecting tenants as best as we can without state law. Locally, we're protecting rental housing best we can, and we're still unaffordable, and it's because we don't build. So that is correct.
Yeah. So I guess, and I see this come up a lot in kind of like online housing wars. There seems to be so much in play outside of zoning. The bizarre incentives that are created by California's Proposition 13 restrictions on property taxes, the hangover from decades of suburbanization and infrastructure development that was meant to encourage suburbanization, the kind of fickle flows of finance capital, which did not really care about infill construction 10 years ago and now want to finance nothing but. Why is zoning the one thing that comes to the top of all the debates?
I'll tell you why. And this may surprise a lot of listeners, but here we have San Francisco known as a tenant city, right?
Mm-hmm.
The majority of residential land in San Francisco, you cannot build a new apartment building. And that's true for all the cities I write about in my book, where the majority of available land, you can't build an apartment building. Why are all the projects planned for the downtown areas and Mission District, for example, or the Tenderloin? It's because you can't build in the whole west side of the city. You can only build, they're zoned for 40 feet, but you can't build a 40-foot rental housing project. You can only build a 40-foot mansion. And that's why I say it doesn't make sense, because how can you have affordable housing on the west side of the city? Because I don't know any nonprofit developer in San Francisco building mansions.
Mm-hmm.
For one person. So that's why it's really density. I'd use the word density rather than zoning, but the two are related. Why have all of our cities, including San Francisco, zoned the majority of their land so only homeowners can live there? And that doesn't make sense, because if you go to the west side, you'll see apartment buildings. The most famous picture of San Francisco is of Alamo Square, the row of Victorians with downtown in the background. It's seen everywhere. What's not seen in that picture is just to the right of the house on the right is an 8-story apartment building. But somehow, and this apartments have become seen as endangering neighborhood character, because these apartments were built in the 30s. They were allowed to be built. And then we made them illegal in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And that's why these sort of housing wars and all the Twitter wars you see, who disagrees with the fact that we should allow apartments throughout cities?
Well, you tell me, because there seems to be a political juggernaut behind preventing that. So where does that come from?
Well, I think it comes from, it's going on like literally there's been 2 days of hearings in Minneapolis about this, and people are making the most negative comments about tenants you've ever heard. It's disgraceful. But I think that for too long in San Francisco, there's been just politicians have not wanted to really get into that because they want the votes from homeowners. And Noe Valley is a classic example, or Bernal Heights. Both are very progressive voting neighborhoods. Both have incredibly strong restrictions on development. And if you're a progressive politician, you need the votes. You don't want to alienate your potential base, part of your base, by getting involved with saying they should maybe have more development in their neighborhood of apartments. So what you do is you say, oh, all developers are greedy and they're just out there for a profit. But wait a minute, if they're not building in those neighborhoods, where are they building? Well, we have 120,000 people commuting every day from Sacramento to the Bay Area. And if you're an environmentalist and you think that's fine, you're off track. So all we do in San Francisco is export the problem. So people are always commuting in on these long drives. And so, but we haven't kind of, the politicians, I understand, you're running for office, you want to say things that get votes. And saying that you think that there should be apartments in single-family home neighborhoods is not seen as a big vote-getter.
Yeah. You wrote the neighborhood control activism of today in opposition to redevelopment in the 1960s. And these were large infrastructure projects that people fought that were getting rid of housing to put
exactly.
up freeways.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the reasons I don't use the term NIMBY, which is very common, is you look at, you know, the people who passed Berkeley's Neighborhood Preservation Ordinance in 1973, which was the first of its kind in the nation.
Championed by Lonnie Hancock.
Yes, Lonnie Hancock made her name at that, and her whole political career was, and actually, if you go back, as I do in the book, and look back at that now, there was a lot of talk about criticizing, we don't want ticky-tack apartments built in our neighborhood. And I said, well, ticky-tack apartments are where the low-income working class can afford to live. I mean, that's really the truth.
They ticky-tack afford, apartments meant two-story, you know,
modern, the
cement,
modern, the modern apartments blocks, we have around Berkeley. Yeah. And but I mean, the reality is that when you limit to single-family homes, you're basically saying if you can't be a homeowner, you can't live in this neighborhood. They become very elitist and racially cause segregation frequently because people of color often can't afford to buy homes as equally as white people. So it was a good momentum because originally when we the downturn of urban America that began after suburbanization with World War II, so they were looking for strategies. Urban renewal came out. It was a disaster virtually everywhere. And so neighborhood groups rose to stop the demolition of their what happened in New York City with Robert Moses and San Francisco destroying SoMa and the Fillmore. So it was good progressive instinct. But what has happened is the notion of neighborhood empowerment has been distorted to become we have the right to prevent tenants living in our neighborhood. And that's not right. And that's not good. And we have to change that.
One of the left critiques when this has been forced as a policy debate, and most recently it was over Senator Scott Wiener's failed SB 827, right, which was a forcible upzoning of virtually the entire city of San Francisco, any place near a bus stop or train station. One of the critiques is you're giving a windfall to landowners and developers by suddenly increasing the developable value of all this land, but not capturing any of the value you've just conjured into existence.
People should look at my Beyond Cron story on that, is that exact issue, because what I said there is, what about the windfall homeowners get in terms of increased property values when they bar new development? I mean, all the homeowners of Bernal Heights, Noe Valley, the Castro, the Haight-Ashbury, check how their property values are going up astronomically every year because they don't let anything be built in their neighborhood, so they artificially restrict supply. We never say, like I wrote an article about it, maybe there should be a tax on homeowner profits because their land use laws are also profiting them. We talk about the developer coming in and making profits, ignoring the fact that existing land use law profits the homeowner. But I think there's ways to do.
But I would point out, you know, Berkeley and Oakland just passed progressive transfer taxes on the most recent ballot. And this is actually a way of capturing some of the value from those skyrocketing home prices.
Well, not till sale, though. And the appreciation, the transfer tax passes that are nowhere near. We're talking people are making, in the last 6 years, homeowners in San Francisco, their equity is enhanced by a million. It's a home in San Francisco. The median price is $1.5 million. There's hardly any neighborhoods you can get any property at all for under $1 million in San Francisco. So we're seeing humongous property raises because of just limiting development. There's only so many places you can live in Bernal Heights. So you buy an existing thing, and there's bidding on each one. So I think, you know, the problem in 827, Scott Wiener just said he's going to renew it when Gavin Newsom's into it. You know, the reason I had a problem with it and criticized it in an article I wrote was the real problem was it didn't talk to Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles has a lot of related ordinances. People in LA didn't get the attention. The tenant groups in LA really were left out. And I think, you know, they know they've hopefully learned to not repeat that mistake this time. You have to have process different than what it was.
Yeah, housing justice groups.
LA, San Francisco is, you know, is a small little town, village compared to LA. And LA has vast number of areas that would be affected by this. And yet, and there are some, the homeowner groups in LA are extraordinarily powerful. But what they needed to do was work with the ACT LA and the LA Transit groups and get them all on board and the tenant groups down there and the housing groups. And that was missed. And so therefore, there was a real process failure last time.
Yeah. But it seems to be a characteristic of a larger rift in housing politics, which is the organizations that you profile in this group. They're colloquially known as YIMBY groups. Yes, in my backyard groups. That have turned out in recent years to support a pro-development agenda in local government meetings have had a very hard time making common cause with tenants' organizations or housing justice groups that have been fighting for affordable housing and community control in a direction that enfranchises working class and poor people in their neighborhoods.
Well, I would question that only because I, you know, as I said, East Bay for Everyone, one of the largest YIMBY groups in the United States, strongly supported Prop 10 and has been on the side of every poor person's issue. And they defend the homeless when they're attacked by the police. I think they're as progressive a group of any type. One could make a comment that tenant groups haven't been very involved in trying to make sure that working class people get access to all the neighborhoods I've mentioned over and over. So I think both sides. But, you know, many people have questioned whether the name YIMBY. Someone can call themselves a YIMBY. I mean, there's many libertarians who are against rent control who call themselves YIMBYs. Mm-hmm. But I don't know who they're speaking for. When you see the people who are actually in the groups, whether it be a Better Cambridge in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or the folks in Minneapolis.
Well, they're making just an extreme version of the supply side argument. They're saying rent control limits the future profitability of development. Therefore, it's going to decrease the amount of housing
built. Well, what I'm saying is that I don't know. I don't think they speak for a broader YIMBY movement. They have mm-hmm. that opinion. I mean, there's many people who call themselves YIMBYs who don't believe in inclusionary zoning, which I think is a critical part of the book to make you have to require developers to have affordable housing on site. And it's interesting. Oakland does not have inclusionary housing, and so there all that stuff you see built on Broadway, all those big projects, there will be no affordable units in them.
Inclusionary zoning, I'll translate for our listeners' benefit. This is the requirement that a fixed percentage of units in a large new development be affordable to people below a specified income threshold. And usually there is an alternative, which is that the developer can just pay a fee
right.
to buy out of building that
right.
unit.
Right, and then it becomes nonprofit, but Oakland doesn't require either. Oakland has a small linkage fee, and you know, I think that I do discuss in the book the counter arguments of people who say that Oakland can't afford, that if you require inclusionary, no housing will be built. But I'll just tell you, I think that you could certainly afford a 10% inclusionary fee in Oakland. And when those Broadway units all open up, and there's just the whole, there's so much housing underway in Oakland, when they open, people are going to start saying, wait a minute, this isn't affordable to anybody in working class. They're too expensive. Why didn't we have some on-site units? Hopefully they'll do that, but LA doesn't have inclusionary housing. And I just have to mention that there was a big battle to overturn this court decision called the Palmer case that the city attorneys in Oakland and Los Angeles, not San Francisco, said was prevented inclusionary housing. So after a multi-year fight in Sacramento in 2017, we got the governor to sign the bill overruling Palmer. And here we are at the end of 2018, and neither LA or Oakland has inclusionary housing. Mm-hmm. So we should figure out what advocates need to push on this.
Yeah, well, it certainly speaks to the amount of power that developers have in city politics, doesn't it? That would be the only organized interest against inclusionary housing.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, city government, if Garcetti, if Mayor Garcetti and Mayor Schaff wanted to have inclusionary housing, I assume it would happen in their cities.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Randy Shaw, his new book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America?